Blog Talk Radio.
Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigators and experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs where families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, private investigator, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Vito have the night off. On April 10, 2006, 65-year-old Sandra White of Weaverville, North Carolina, was killed by her 73-year-old husband, Ray. He staged the house to make it appear that the death was the result of a robbery gone bad. He even went so far as to drive down the highway and throw Sandra's purse out alongside the road as a robber may have done. However, after several days of questioning by the police, Ray White admitted to causing Sandra's fatal injuries. He was subsequently charged with involuntary manslaughter and posted a $100,000 bail. And then things turned a bit weird. The judge released White to the custody of his brother, David White, in Florida. Sandra's family believed that today Ray is living in St. Petersburg and enjoying life as a free man. The now 78-year-old has yet to stand trial in the North Carolina court. The family's efforts to get answers from the North Carolina authorities have met with non-responses, inaccurate information, and stonewalling. Joining us to discuss the case are Gene Cervantes of Citizens Against Homicide and Sandra's nieces, Tamara Kramer and Heather Snyder. Welcome, Gene, Tamara, and Heather.
Thank you.
Thank you, Denny.
Let me start out with the Tamara. Tamara, please tell us, if you can, how it is that Ray White has gone now some 5 years since your aunt's death. Apparently with no further court action. Is there an explanation for that?
Well, the only explanation that I've gotten for the last 5 years is that they were waiting for the evidence to come back from the lab.
And when you say they, you mean the prosecutors?
Yes. And we've called repeatedly, and they keep saying we're waiting. And then on the fifth year anniversary of her death, I called, and Joyce Passmore, who is the victim advocate there, said that the evidence did come back from the lab, but that the FBI did not test it, and they had to resubmit the evidence.
Okay, let me stop you for just a second here. I just got a message in the chat room. I didn't activate the chat room till late, so anybody who's listening and would like to join the chat room, you need to refresh. And you'll be able to get in now. Okay, thank you. So the apparently, if I understand this right, Ray White admitted after questioning to a detective, a police detective, that he had caused or been in a fight, I guess you call it, an altercation with Sandra. And as a result of that altercation, she sustained injuries that were life-threatening, in fact, were fatal. But he also claimed that Sandra took the first swing, if you will, or attacked him first, and was trying to claim self-defense. Is that what you understand, Heather?
Yeah, that's what we thought his defense was.
Okay,
but we don't believe it.
Because he hasn't been to court yet, nobody really knows for sure, right?
Right.
Okay. Gene Cervantes, what's your understanding of the case? Do you have any different information or anything additional to what the ladies have?
No, not really. I got a call from Heather back in, I believe it was February or March of 2009. And the irony of the whole thing is that I figured, okay, he's arrested, he posted bond, and that was it. I kind of put the file aside after I got all the information, that is, and didn't think anything of it. And then April of this year, Heather called me again, and I've been talking with both Heather and Tammy ever since. But I said, okay, how's the trial going? How did the trial go? And I was shocked to hear that nothing has happened. There's been no prosecution, nothing, absolutely nothing. I've attempted to make phone calls, and I get no callbacks. I get referred, we can't help you. You need to call this office, and we can't help you. You need to call this office. It's just Keystone Cops.
Tom Shamshack, does anything about this sound weird to you, or is this normal?
No, this is very peculiar. I'd like to clarify something. The family seems to have been given the runaround, and let me just find out here. You asked if the FBI had analyzed material forwarded to the FBI lab, presumably in Quantico, Virginia, and you were told by the local authorities that it had to be resubmitted. And then apparently sometime in the future, you had direct contact with the FBI and learned that nothing had been analyzed?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And they told me to call the FBI. They said they had never received anything.
Well, you know, there's something very peculiar here. What's the relationship with the person of interest, the suspect, the husband, with respect to local law enforcement? Tell us about him. What are his roots in this community?
Ray?
Yep.
I can't imagine that he would have anything, you know, to make this happen. His lawyer, we heard, is shady. My mom's cousin is a retired detective. A PI, and he told us that his lawyer was very shady. So I wonder if I don't know, you know, is he in cahoots with the DA? We don't know. All these things are, you know, speculation, because we know nothing and they won't tell us anything.
Well,
and they
highly
won't even
unusual.
Call us back. Mm-mm.
This is highly unusual.
They don't acknowledge us at all, basically.
And if I'm correct, ladies, the family, and it was apparently you two ladies, the spearhead of it, are doing this on your own, right? You don't have an attorney, you don't have private investigators. Everything is your own doing here.
Right.
Yeah. So because we're out of state, you know, we just have to do what we can through the phone.
Have you contacted the local media down there?
Yes, I did.
And what has been their response?
No response.
Well, there's a big speed bump in the road here.
So, what have you got in the works? I know you've got phone calls pending and so forth that aren't being returned. What is your next step? Now, is it going back to, what is it, the SBI? What's that, State Bureau of Investigation?
Yes, and they told me to call the Sheriff's Office of Buncombe County. I called the Sheriff's Office. She tells me if I want any information, I have to call the DA's office. So I'm back to square one.
It's just pass the buck. That's all it is.
I also talked to someone in the Attorney General's office. She... this was back in November of last year. She talked to me and never called me back, but when I called her, she said everything was on track. Now, that was in November of 2010. When I called her recently, she did not call me back.
Tom at least, mentioned the possibility of a reporter. It's very difficult with both of you being out of state, as you mentioned.
Yes.
Because you can't be there at the doorstep every morning when these people come to work.
Yeah, otherwise...
Demanding an answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if there were only some way to get an investigative reporter to stick, locally...
Yeah.
To stick their nose into this, because they would have undoubtedly the contacts and possibly the influence. I mean, let's face it, politicians and public figures... one thing that strikes fear in their hearts is to get the press sniffing around if they've done anything wrong or maybe aren't living up to their job expectations. So that certainly could be a great tool, a great asset to your goals of trying to find out what is going on. I'm just wondering, I'm not that familiar at all with North Carolina. I've never been there. But... I'm just thinking in general terms, Gene. What else can they do? Could they, the governor's office? I don't know. Where do you go when you can't get an answer from the people who should be giving you answers?
They've been to everybody, and I referred them to the district attorney, thinking that nothing was, talking with them, nothing was done at the local law enforcement level. So I said, well, find out what's going on with the district attorney. No phone calls back. I mean, they ignore Tammy's phone calls. They don't give any return phone calls. Tammy, did you get a hold of the State Attorney General's office?
No.
Okay, that might be an option. You see, we don't, on this show, we've said it before, we don't like, bashing of law enforcement. But this is a type of behavior in law enforcement that causes people to doubt the sincerity and legitimacy of law enforcement, and they wonder just exactly where the integrity is. Unfortunately, it's just a minute a number of law enforcement agencies around the United States, but still, it's bothersome, to say the least.
Let's toss some ideas. I was just wondering, I'm trying to think of a way to either interest some local media in North Carolina or maybe... political, some politicians are. I'm just wondering if maybe opening a website such as a Facebook site or something, Seeking Justice for Sandra type thing, to try to get people interested who could email, and maybe you could put on the website the email address of the district attorney's office, the sheriff's department, whatever.
We couldn't even get the email address of Paul.
Oh, God.
Can I jump in here with a
suggestion? I wanted to let him know that we were going to be on this radio show, and we couldn't get it.
Let me offer you this. I know there are a lot of colleges in North Carolina, and I'm quite sure that journalism is taught in more than a handful of universities there. Reach out to somebody in a journalism department that has an investigative reporting component. A lot of them do. They take on cases such as this to explore the breakdown in our criminal justice system. That's, I think, some place to start. You might also consider trying to get a private investigator on the case, and that's another avenue to pursue.
I would, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Tom, because I was mulling that over myself, and I'm wondering if I'm thinking that you're not looking for the whole case to be investigated. In other words, you're not looking for somebody to go over what the police did as far as their investigation, but somebody maybe go to the courthouse and go different places and check and see what's been filed, what's going on in that regard. Maybe somebody with boots on the ground, as they say, could kind of get some answers in a fairly short time. Do you think that's possible?
Precisely, to have somebody examine the pleadings and determine how this case has fallen through the cracks and why this is not scheduled, why the, particularly after 5 years, why forensic evidence has not been analyzed. There should certainly be results now.
And do you think, Tom, is there any possibility that the evidence could have been somehow lost or compromised, and that's the hold up here, and nobody's willing to admit it? Is that a possibility?
It is. Again, I think an inquiry from whomever would reveal that. I mean, I think that you first have to look at the pleadings. Okay, the case is there. He's been charged. All right. Why hasn't justice continued here? Why hasn't there been due process?
Yeah.
That's the big looming question here.
Absolutely. What do you think about that, ladies? Is that, again, I have no idea how much this would cost. I don't know hours.
If you could get somebody from a journalism school as a start, obviously this would be an interesting case for students under the supervision of a college professor to take a look at.
Okay.
Because the question here is, why has this case stalled in the North Carolina justice system? That's it.
Yeah. Well, we had also wondered about the evidence that it may be lost, and somebody needs to answer.
Well, let's explore that. Why do you think the evidence has been misplaced?
Well, because we just can't. There is no other explanation. Like, why? This is an open and shut case. You know, why is this happening? And that's just one of the things that has been thrown around, that the evidence maybe is lost.
Every time we call, they say we're waiting for the evidence.
Uh-huh.
How long does it take for evidence to come back from the lab? What's a reasonable time period? I don't think 5 years is a reasonable time period.
You're right. 5 years is unreasonable. With blood evidence, you could go anywhere from a year to, two years out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some states, Florida has the capability in some counties to turn it around within 72 hours. Now, I don't know why they sent evidence off to the FBI lab in Virginia. Maybe North Carolina didn't have the capability to do, forensics on the blood spatter. But more importantly, from what I read in the materials that we were provided with, there's plenty of testimonial evidence from the perpetrator himself. He's confessed.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yes.
So the question
is, while he was in a rehab center, to a detective. So I'm assuming they would have had him sign a statement, wouldn't you think?
Yes, and more importantly, they may have videotaped and audio recorded.
Oh.
Bring in a video recording instrument and memorialized the confession on tape.
Mm-hmm. And would that be with the evidence? Would they keep
that?
No,
that would be separate. No.
That would
be in the case file.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where he is right now?
As far as we know, he's living with his brother in Florida, and they told us that he would have to call in once a day, and that was all. That was his only stipulation. Now, he has a son that lives in Japan, and that's another concern. What would stop him from, you know, leaving the country to live with his son in Japan?
Well, he shouldn't be leaving the country if he's been charged with manslaughter. Is that the charge? Have you seen the paperwork?
Involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah.
Have you seen the court documents, the complaint, the criminal complaint?
No, we have not.
Well, I think that's the place you need to start, is to actually have somebody go to the court and pull the records. Those are public records. They can be examined.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a schedule of the arraignment date, when the pretrial hearing was set. The next time would be a pretrial conference. There would be evidentiary proceedings for the government to at least lay out its case, some type of a statement of the facts that they're going to bring forward in the prosecution. His attorney would then ask for, through a motion, all information that will be used in the prosecution. So I think that's what you need to examine to find out where this is. What is the status of this case in the North Carolina judicial system?
And, Tom, don't you think in addition to a journalism school, that maybe even a college with a criminal justice course that might be of interest to them?
Oh, no doubt about it. Or law school. I think any of those options, Tamara, you know, if you want to give us a call offline in a few days, you know, we could perhaps give you give you a list of potential options for you to pursue. I mean, this is really outrageous. It is.
I'm
at a loss to explain why this case has stalled.
And we put our trust in the DA, and they have just left us by the roadside on this. And Sandy was the youngest of nine, and her siblings are dying now and not seeing justice for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, let me back up just a second. Did you say earlier in the show that you had been led to believe that certain evidence had been sent to the FBI lab for testing?
Yes.
You
mm-hmm.
called the FBI lab and spoke with a person, and the person said, well, no, we've never received anything. Is that what it is, or they just hadn't tested it yet?
No, they said they never received any evidence.
So, well, that might make you a little skeptical about the condition or status of the evidence. The local people in North Carolina, who's at the DA's office, or who told you it was at the FBI?
Joyce Passmore is the only one that's ever really spoken to me, and she would be considered just the mouthpiece for the DA or someone. You know,
the DA's office told you evidence had been sent to the FBI lab, and they were waiting for the report or for the analysis
mm-hmm.
to be completed before they could proceed in court.
That's correct.
You call the FBI to get the status, and they say, we don't know what you're talking about. We've never received anything in this case. Tom, can you read anything into that?
Well, again, I can't. other than it's preposterous for them to be telling the family, oh, yes, we are awaiting results, when in fact nothing seems to have been submitted to the FBI lab. This case has fallen through the cracks. Now, it could be because of the influence that the defense attorney has, and these are explorations that have to be undertaken here to see what the relationships are. I think a lot of background work needs to be done on Ray and his affiliation, as well as his attorney, with the local criminal justice system.
Yeah, it's something just, you know, it's my favorite expression is it doesn't pass the smell test or something.
Yeah.
something bizarre. So what do you ladies think about the suggestion of going to a local college or a North Carolina college and seeing if
something I hadn't thought of. Have you, Jimmy?
Yeah, a journalism school or a criminal justice or even a law school.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in fact, that sounds to me, Tom, if I were a professor, that would be a great project for me to assign some students to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure.
You know, they'd probably love it. And it, the price would be right, too.
Yeah,
ladies, what they would do is they would do the searching for you, and they would do the interviewing, interview the family members and get out there on the landscape. I mean, this is a real, it's not a whodunit, it's a why hasn't it been followed through?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tom, this is Gene. It appears that a good place, if not the first place to start before they go to the college would be the state attorney general, since he's the top cop or she's the top cop in the state. Don't you think, or am I?
Well, they've already been there.
Yeah, I talked to a lady named Rose White Hearn, I think her name was, and she was actually a domestic violence advocate with the general's office. And she has not called me back recently. You know, like I said, I talked to her in November, and she said everything was on track. In April, no response.
See, I thought that was the district attorney instead of the attorney general.
I tried going over their heads.
Yeah.
You know, I see that you did write a letter of complaint to the state of North Carolina Judicial Standards Commission back in February of 2009, and they basically said that judicial standards didn't handle that type of complaint. I'm just wondering, and I've seen a copy of that letter in response, but are you keeping or trying to do some of these other things with phone calls and letters to create a paper trail of who you've been in touch with and hopefully get them to respond in writing so you can have something to refer to, you know, about what you've been told?
Yeah, we're learning the hard way.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, right now I have a pile about 6 inches thick of scribbled notes. And, I need to do that.
Yeah, it just seems Tom and Gene probably would both agree with me that when you get into situations such as these, it's always nice if you can document, you know, what you've done or what other people have done, because, you know, if you have to keep trying to go up the ladder to a different office or a different agency and so forth, and they question, you know, what you've done in the past or try to refer you elsewhere, you can say, we've already been there, and here's what we were told. Because, and we talked Tamara and I last night, that sometimes it seems these agencies kind of just wear you down. You know, I mean, when you get the doors shut in your face for so many months or years, some people, I think, just give up. The system beats them.
Yeah, after that fifth phone call, you know, it's just like you just get so frustrated.
Yeah.
I can understand that. And
no,
if any help you offline, you know, please get back to us.
Yeah.
Tammy, I'm going to send you some information on the Freedom of Information Act also.
Okay.
In case they try to stonewall you again.
Okay.
Yeah, there's certain things you get, and even though each state is a little bit different on their so-called sunshine laws or freedom of information stuff, I believe every state today has some form of a Freedom of Information Act. It might have a different title. But I know the police can withhold certain documents with the explanation they're not releasable because they have an open investigation or that type of thing. But I think, court records or those, what you're really after is not police reports. You're after the court information.
Yeah, it's public record.
Public records. Those are public records.
So, yeah, it seems as though there ought to be several ways to go. Would you like Tamara and Heather, like Tom said, if you want to get a hold of us in a day or two or whatever, if we've had a chance to kind of digest everything we've talked about tonight, and if we can do anything to help, Gene's going to send you some information about the Freedom of Information stuff. And if you'd like to talk with us further, you know, about our suggestions and recommendations, anything we can help with, we'll certainly be here for you.
Okay. Thank you.
And I also have a contact, and I'm not so sure that she's not listening tonight, but I have a contact in North Carolina that will also be able to help me get North Carolina's Freedom of Information laws, or information on them, I'm sorry. So call me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Heather. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you, Gene.
Thank you
for your help.
Thank you,
Tom.
Thank
you, guys. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. We'll switch gears here and get into our second case tonight, which comes to us from the Q Center, the case of the month. Jessica Lowry disappeared from Lumberton, North Carolina on December 20th, 2005. The then 25-year-old left her residence at approximately 3 a.m. and has not been seen since. Monica Kaysen from the Q Center and Jessica's father, Jimmy, are here with us to talk about the disappearance and the ongoing investigation. Monica, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having us.
Monica, good evening. Let me kick it right to you and give us an update on the status of the investigation and tell us what's going on.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, we just got involved with Jessica's case about 2 months ago, and we are gearing up to sit down and have a meeting with law enforcement to pretty much review what has been done, what hasn't been done. But I can tell you, I've been in touch already with them, and they are very eager to do whatever they can as far as to help her case. So I'm excited about that. In addition, there really hasn't, when she first became missing, I think her case kind of fell between the cracks. And that's, you know, it happens a lot in all of these cases. And it goes on forever until people reach out and get the proper help. So I'm hoping that we will be able to get some accomplishments with our law enforcement. We're going to be putting up a billboard. We're going to be conducting a awareness campaign to get her case out there. We're going to be featuring her alongside of some other missing persons from that region as well, and we're going to address that issue. And hopefully we're already getting tips in. We put up a website for her, and we're already starting to get moving on that. So I think we're in a good spot right now as far as getting the community and getting our case out there, which tonight is another avenue to do so.
Right.
And so I'm hopeful that we're, you know, going to be a lot of people get a conscience in the middle of the night, I've always found out. And those emails and phone calls that come in are very helpful with information. So I'm hoping that we'll be at a place we can search for Jessica in the next couple months for sure.
Good. And now is her dad here? Jimmy?
Yes, sir. Yes, I'm here.
Good evening. Hi. Would you tell our listeners about your daughter? Give us some background on her, and then we'll get into the facts about her disappearance. So tell us something about your daughter.
Yes, sir. Jessica was a sweet girl. I mean, she was a hard worker, and she loved her kids well. She loved her kids very well. And, you know, she just, to me, it was like hooked up with the wrong crowd, started hanging around the wrong crowd, my opinion.
Okay. How many children did she have?
She has three. She has two boys and one girl.
Okay. And what do you think happened? Why do you think she's missing?
I really don't. Go ahead.
you didn't think she went off on her own?
No, sir. I don't think so. The reason I say that is because pretty much all my life I worked second shifts, and I don't know. I was a type that I'm straight up, and if one of my kids is not, to me, on the right path, you know, I'd be a little hard on them, talking to them and stuff, well, what they need to do. But she would always leave me a message. A lot of times she wouldn't call me when I'm home. She'd always wait till I leave, and she never failed. Every other week she would call me, and she would tell me, she said, Dad, I love you. And she said, you know why? Sometimes, you know, I don't call you because, you know, you tell me this, you tell me that, and I know I need to do what you say I really need to be doing. But, you know.
Okay. Now, have you registered her with the National Center for Missing Adults?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
All right. And
yes,
you and Monica's working with you now?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And you have a website up now that Monica got involved?
Yes, sir. We sure do. The Cube Center.
Okay.
She has a profile on our organization as well, but she also has her own site, which is helpfindjessicalowry.com.
Okay, that's good. Denny, your thoughts?
Yeah. First of all, Monica, let me ask you, because you're very experienced in these situations. And if you could tell me what every time we talk or profile one of the Cube cases, we always hear about websites, web pages, and billboards.
Right.
Could you tell us, in your opinion, what the value and how important it is to have a web page or website and to try to get a billboard up?
Well, a lot of these cases, you know, always come to us cold. And when they're, you know, a cold case or an inactive case, the most important thing right away is establishing some kind of groundwork, getting them prevalent on the internet, getting them out in the community, getting them out to press outlets and start telling their story. Because unless people know that we're seeking information or law enforcement seeking information, and unless people know this person is missing, you know, that's a battle already to start with. So that's important, and that's, we always try to first get the case up to date, which we're requesting CODIS and different things for the case from the law enforcement, because basically she's a missing person and kind of no one knows about it. You know, when she went missing, and I was doing some research on the two articles, or not even articles, but two things that were on her in the database, one of them was she was entered as a missing person 3 years after she was reported missing. So I had a big problem with that. And then her case isn't up to date. You know, the DNA is not on file. You know, her dentals aren't on file. And so, you know, we're trying to get basically her case up to date. These things are important, one for an identification process. The awareness programs that we put in place immediately is to get not only the case out there, but also to give an opportunity for people to step forward and to give information without really getting involved. And we want to base that trust value out there to communities that, you know, here's a number you can call, here's law enforcement you can call, but here's also another number you can call that will get to law enforcement, but basically third party, and you won't be involved. And that's very effective in all the cases that we're working. We have to build, you know, that trust value in those communities and let people reach out, because there's always information in every community concerning a missing person and information that was missed and maybe even information that was told 2 or 3, 4 years ago and then just kind of got put to the side. So we need to hear from those people, and we want to make sure law enforcement gets that information to help build, you know, some sort of investigation for this girl. I mean, you cannot, you know, you just can't vanish and be forgotten. The families are left behind, and they're not forgetting. So it's, you know, we have to get that information back out there and start making other people not forget and other people to put pressure on. So the awareness is vital in any missing person, whether it happens today or whether it happened 5, 10 years ago. It's important to revisit and start all over, like this person just got missing. So when we get cases, and no matter how old they are or how young they are, when they come to us, the very first thing is we start doing our checklist. You know, are they in CODIS? Are they in NAMIS? Are they here? Are they here? And we start filling in those gaps and making sure they're registered with all the proper agencies and that their case is up to date, then we begin an awareness campaign to aid law enforcement in tips and leads. We establish our contact and relationship with law enforcement, and then we start coming together with a collective plan to further that so we can ultimately get to a place to search for this missing person so we can hopefully have some kind of recovery. And that's what any case is. It's a continual work towards, you know, getting tips and leads to get to a place to search. And every time it starts to die down, you have to think of another event you can hold to continue, again, reaching out and getting information.
Yeah, it's an ongoing process, isn't it?
It's a constant ongoing process. You know, when a person first gets missing, everyone sees it. You know, they have the candlelight vigils. They'll have a balloon release, a prayer vigil, or something like that. You know, families abroad the nation have learned, you know, from advocates such as myself and many, many others out there. But what they forget is that there are cases out there that never had the candlelight vigil and so forth, and they've gone cold from the day they were born. And, you know, years later, where do you start? So you have to start with the awareness. If, you know, there's not a significant date coming up, then we can't really hold the candlelight vigil or something like that. So we reach out to the billboards. We reach out to an awareness campaign of that type of magnitude to get that person out there bigger than life and saying, hey, you know, here's something you didn't know about, and put them on a, you know, a 30 by 24, 28, or even 46-foot, you know, billboard and say, this is something you don't know about. We want to educate your community. And before you know it, you've got people talking. Billboards are very effective in missing person cases, no matter what age they are.
Monica, how did the case come to your attention?
Well, basically, this particular area is very rural area. There's a lot of not a lot of communication, and we do have cases in that region. And I believe Jimmy had actually talked to one of our other families at some kind of event or what have you. I'm not really clear, and he was given our contact information and said, "God, you've got to reach out," you know, because he was telling his story to another what he didn't even know family that had a missing person.
Uh-huh.
And he was telling his story, and they just ended up, you know, he's like, you need to get up with, you know, we're registered with the Q Center. They've been working with us for years on our case and, you know, kind of that type of thing. And he did, and he went through all the proper registration, and now we've just begun, you know, working on his case. And many cases come like that, especially people that have either, one, don't know what to do and live in these type of communities where you don't have a lot of it's basically word of mouth. You know, there's still people in North Carolina in a lot of these communities that don't read and write, don't watch TV or don't have cable, and they don't even receive a newspaper. So, you know, it's kind of hard unless you're in their community working or, you know, putting visuals up or actually doing events in front of Walmart or what have you, that you'll even reach these type of people.
Monica, do you work with any PIs there in North Carolina? Is there somebody that you can reach out to for some investigative work to help Jimmy?
Absolutely. We have many investigators that we work with across the nation, and yes, we do. In Jimmy's case, if I feel at any point he would need a private investigator, then we would get him one. But right now, you know, our organization works so closely with law enforcement, and we have worked with cases and do work currently with cases in this particular agency, so we're already a trusted resource, and I don't think there's going to be any problem with forthwith of information and everybody working on the same goal plan. But if I were to see that, you know, to be a problem, then I would definitely, you know, reach out for a different resource for him.
Okay. Do they have any persons of interest that they think might have been responsible for her disappearance?
I do believe they are a few people of interest. I don't want to say persons of interest as far as like a suspect, but definitely I think there are some people that their names keep popping up and ironically enough have popped up in another missing person that I have from about 15 years ago. So, you know, and that's another thing we're going to be addressing to have that looked into. But, you know, there's not a lot of rumors on the street in the areas in North Carolina that are populated by a lot of the Indian culture. You have to really get out and win the trust of the people and they before they'll come forward because there's not a lot of protection for them. And it's definitely a problem that I know and I'm aware of and I know how to work with that type of situation. But, you know, the Indian population is a very insecure as far as being protected by law enforcement, because there are very rural towns, and they maybe have just a few cops here and there. Jimmy obviously lives in one of the better towns that has, you know, a larger police department, but they have to cover so much, and they're so inundated with every Friday night crime that a missing person or something what they consider smaller value definitely goes unnoticed and not worked as sometime as much as we would hope they would.
Okay.
Jimmy, going back to when your daughter disappeared, it said that she left her residence and hasn't been seen since, but I was just curious, did she have a car? If so, is the car missing also, or didn't she have a vehicle? And the old cell phone thing and credit card usage and all that kind of stuff, was anything was there anything involved there?
No, sir. As far as I know, she didn't have a car. I knew that. She didn't have a credit card. Cell phone, I don't never remember her having. So any of that stuff there, I don't never remember her having anything like that.
And did the police indicate, or I'm not sure, you know, familiar with the area your daughter lived in, but would she have passed by any stores or anything that might have had security cameras or surveillance cameras, anything like that?
The only store I would think she would pass, I wouldn't think they had, I think they got them on the inside. I wouldn't think they had them on the outside. But that's a good thing you just brought up, because I haven't even thought of that. And I know I was at that store here a couple of weeks ago, and I knew that I wanted to put some flyers up at the door and stuff. And they told me, you know, that would work. That was last week. But the next time I go back, I'm going to ask them, do they have cameras on the outside?
And a question about the police. Now, obviously, this is, you know, a missing persons case for them. And as Monica indicated, manpower-wise and so forth, they have to prioritize. But do they keep in touch with you, or have they confided in you a theory, if they have a theory of what might have happened, or do they keep in touch with you on a regular basis?
To be honest, no, sir. No, sir. If I don't hear from them this week, normally every other week I'll call the detectives and ask them, have he got on any leads or anything like that? And so far he's told me no. So, and most of the time it's me calling him. It's not him calling me, it's me calling him, just trying to find out if anything's come up.
But you have a specific, or they've assigned a specific officer or detective to this case, so you know the right person to deal with.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I got a direct line to him he give me. I found out he was on the case, to where, you know, if I hear anything, for him to check in behind it, or, you know, anything ever comes up, you know, then that way I can let him know that I've heard, you know, different things, and for him to check into it.
Monica, in this case, or actually any case that Q gets involved in, you then do touch base with the handling agency or agency of jurisdiction to let them know you're involved and that you're, you know, going to be putting up billboards or websites and this kind of thing.
Yes, and you know, struggling through this case and hearing Jimmy talk is the prime reason why people need advocates and be involved with a reputable organization, because this will change as far as the communication and accountability in her case. These are the stories I hear every day that I heard from a family today that they haven't talked to their detective in 9 years. They don't even know who's on their case, and they call and call to no avail, never get a call back. And these are some of the things Jimmy has experienced as well. Even though he can reach a detective in his case, he's always told the same thing. Well, you know, we haven't heard anything new. You know, you have a nice day. And that's got to change, you know, because this is his daughter, and this is his case, and he's allowed this investigation, you know, these investigators to investigate. But, you know, to give him an answer like that for all of these years is not acceptable anymore. I mean, you know, it's been 6 years. So, you know, we've come to a time at the, you know, at the line of the road that, you know, you either need to get a task force on this, you need to reevaluate, go back over, start all over again, re-interview people, whatever you have to do, but there has to be some kind of resolve to this case, and it's not going to happen, excuse me, by, you know, Jimmy sitting back and accepting that, you know, it's okay to make that phone call. You know, he's doing the initiative, but he doesn't buck the system, and that's the way, unfortunately, a lot of people down there are, you know, they... I don't want to say scared of law enforcement, but they're like, oh, okay, you know, thanks for taking my call. And yeah. So we will change that, and that will change very, very soon.
And, you know, I'm really glad to hear that because, in fact, the case we had on prior to Q tonight was another situation. It wasn't a missing person, but it was this communication issue with the governmental agencies. It's just... scary and frustrating that these governmental agencies, when you have a victim's family out there with certainly a vital interest in what's happening and what's going on with the case, and you can't get a return phone call, you got to chase them. I mean, it's a Tom. What are your thoughts on that? And we hear this every week. I mean, it isn't one isolated incident. It's constant.
It's a familiar litany that is disappointing to hear. And the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and you really have to continue, Jimmy, to press them, stay on top of it, and insist on an update.
What I do in a lot of those instances, if I have someone who doesn't return a call in a significant amount of time and I have to call back again, there will be no third phone call. I will normally either email and copy everyone in the division on it that I have called, you know, two times on these such and such dates and times and left messages and still have not had a return phone call. And then my next step will be I will fax the agency so there's constantly a paper trail. Every time I've ever had to, which is very few times, but any time that I've had to fax an officer saying I'm trying to reach you and you're not acknowledging my phone calls, within minutes of that fax going in, no more than a half hour, I receive a phone call because nobody wants a paper trail. And it shouldn't never have to get to that because, you know, I know everybody's busy and everybody has caseloads and what have you, but the bottom line is you have to show, you know, you wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for the victims of crime and the crime happening. So because of these people, you have a job and you serve them and you take an oath and you need to live up to that oath. And it's not about being too busy and just drawing a paycheck. You know, you have to try to make a difference. And as a law officer, you know, I think they you know, I don't expect them to get out there and advocate, but I do expect them to show some sort of empathy and some sort of structure in how they're handling their cases and some kind of compassion towards the victims that are left behind. So we try to make sure that's established with the law enforcement, and I've been blessed because a lot of the law enforcement we work with across the nation, they're awesome. I really don't have many, many complaints, but every now and again you're reminded of why you became an advocate. And so you just have to, you know, step up to those challenges and overcome them and let them know that, you know, this family is in control of their case. And they do have rights, and they also have, in addition, civil rights. So we can even go that matter if we have to. So, you know, you've got victim rights and you've got civil rights, and you can exercise them all. So,
Jimmy, I got to say that you're blessed and thank your lucky stars to have Monica and Q involved, because if you've listened to our last little discussion here, if you don't have an advocate on your behalf dealing with some of these agencies, and a lot of cases you got to deal with multiple agencies. It's not just the local police department. It could be the medical examiner. It could be the district attorney. It could be the attorney general, whatever. And, you can end up, you know, trying to go it alone is an awesome task. And, I mean, a lot of people just can't get through it. So you're really fortunate to have Monica.
I did want to comment on that last segment you guys just did very quickly that I didn't get to hear at all, but I guess this person is struggling from a homicide or being a victim or what have you. The first thing she needs to do is align herself with a court advocate. If she is a victim of homicide, every state through the DA's office, have to assign her a victim's advocate for the court process. And that victim's advocate is your communication to the court system, to the police, and to whom all is concerned in the investigation, and the ongoing investigation and prosecution of your case. And there, so, you know, and I would employ her to call us. We'll give her the numbers. I can give her the head lady to call right away, and she will get things moving for her because she does not have to go on this alone. There's also, you know, mothers and parents of victims of homicide. A lot of DA offices hold a monthly meeting for victims of homicide. She needs to check into that in her community and start tapping into those groups and aligning herself with parents or loved ones that are left behind with victims of homicide or crime. And they're everywhere. They're in every community. You just have to look for them. And I'll be glad to give her, you know, I don't know what state or whatever she's in, but I'll be glad to get her started and in the right hands of somebody that can definitely help her along, because they do not. Victims of homicide actually have more rights and have more avenues out there for help than missing persons, and they're everywhere.
Well, thank you, Monica, for that offering. You're dead on there. That's something that it's an excellent perspective, one that we missed.
Yeah, and Monica, if I understood you right, now see, here's, because you didn't listen to the whole segment, the homicide took place in North Carolina. The nieces who are fighting, trying to get justice, are in Pennsylvania, but they could still, as family, next of kin or whatever, call the North Carolina court system, right, or DA's office for this victim.
Wherever the crime happened, and in North Carolina, it's Van, and Victims Assistant is Network, and they will assign not only an advocate through that, but also, if the crime happened in North Carolina, whatever jurisdiction that law enforcement is, they can request a victim's advocate through the police department. And North Carolina is one of the tightest hooked up systems that we have for victims. So there is no excuse there. Tons of resources. And matter of fact, even when I'm working issues of a missing person that is found that becomes a homicide victim in another state, I still call my programs here in North Carolina to get them moving, the other people in another state. I can still call North Carolina to get that victim agency involved in another state to put those people in place for the family. So there, if this is involved in North Carolina, I mean, we have so many groups and so many programs in place. In every state, we have a homicide victims program, and it is Victims Compensation Fund, and it's through that. Whoever's housing that, there's programs through that. They can hook you up with every group in that state, meeting time, just like, you know, AA. It's set up just like that, where you can find any church, a meeting place to go and meet. I mean, it's set up through every state. So you just have to get the first step in the door and someone to give you the proper number to call, and you'll be on your way.
Well, Monica, I hope that Tamara and Heather are listening. We'll follow up with you on that. Thank you.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And what I was going to suggest is we were trying to build a resources page on our website. It's a work in progress, but I don't think we have any, because this is the first I remember hearing about all these resources. Would you be willing to maybe talk some time with Delilah or Kim and get some information that they could put up on our CrimeWire
absolutely.
Website for people in these situations? Because we'd like to get the information available in as many places as possible, so there's a better chance that people will see it and be able to get help.
Absolutely. And like I said, there's so many, you know, and I have this argument every day with missing persons and families about, you know, I wish there was more resources for missing persons and we had more help down here on the ground, but it's definitely growing. But there is definitely a structure. I said, when your loved one's found and they're a homicide, everybody will come running. You've got all kinds of programs out there to jump on board. But it's the part of you being, you having a missing loved one, that there's not enough help through that part of being a victim. And that's phase one. And then phase two is the recovery. And then phase three is your justice system. And the other two systems are locked down good and tight. But the first system with the actually suffering the missing person, it just isn't it isn't as fruitful as far as all the resources. But, you know, I've been out there almost 17 years this September, and I can tell you, you know, victim of homicide, there is no excuse. There are tons of advocacy groups, groups that meet, that are set up through government and non-government. There's programs in place. Do you, and I do want to add this. If you're a homicide victim in any state, that compensation fund compensates you to help you pay for the funeral of your loved one. And we have a process set up with you. When we have a recovery, we automatically put that family in touch with that advocate. She comes to their home, fills out the paperwork with them, and gets them settled so they can don't even have the stress of worrying about the funeral. And that's set up in every single state. So, and it's
wow,
a lot of people know that.
That's great information.
That's absolutely great, and we are going to get this hooked up with you, Monica, to get this out there. Listen, we ran out of time here. We're being recorded now, but we lost the live stream. Jimmy, I want to thank you so much for being on with us.
Yes, sir.
And the best of luck, and I certainly hope everything works out, and you got a good team in your corner here, so I'm optimistic.
I really believe that. I really do. I thank God every night for Miss Monica. I really do.
Well, thank you, Jimmy, and thank you very much, Monica, and we'll be in touch about that information.
You're very welcome. Thank you for hearing Jessica's story.
Oh. Good night, folks. If,
all right.
If you would like, just if please, thanks to the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at Imagine Publicity. We are taking off next Tuesday for the 4th of July holiday, and our next show will be on Tuesday, July 12th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us on CrimeWire tonight. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume of your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. Good night,
Tom.
Good
night.